again, very assured, like there wasn't a false note. Obviously loves seeing Sam Elliott. Glad
I was going to say.
Love him.
Like, I know, okay, you don't care for Bradley Cooper, you don't care for Lady Gaga, fine, but give love it up Sam for Elliott. My man Sam Elliott.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 52, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. And I'm joined by my fellow rock stars, Ebony Adams and Carolyn Pettit.
Hi.
Yo.
That's what rock stars say.
Yo.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today, we're diving into the latest iteration of A Star is Born with Lady Gaga and that generic white dude that seems to be in everything. After that, we'll finish by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? Now on with the show. All right, I got two important things to mention. One, I'm in a different studio today, and sitting next to me is a little plastic sword from Transistor, if you remember that game.
Oh, yeah.
But when you take the top off, it's a USB stick. It is so cute. I wish you could all see this thing.
I just rewatched an episode of Elementary where a guy had a prosthetic pinky.
Oh, and I remember
a USB
that.
Stick hidden in the pinky.
That shit was ridiculous.
Yep.
Could you imagine?
Yes.
I mean, technically you're a cyborg at that point, right?
Oh, yeah.
Also, Transistor just came out on Switch.
Oh, really? I didn't really like that game.
So, you know,
Second point is I think that this is our one-year anniversary show, which we probably should have done something more exciting than talk about this movie, but here we are. Yay!
I'm eating cake right now.
What?
I said I'm eating cake to celebrate right now.
While we're recording?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Well, I mean, not right this second, but...
Are you going to bake us a cake for all of us?
No, I'm not.
No. See?
Like, this is a solo celebration.
All right. Carolyn, please give us some entertainment news.
Actually, Anita, I'll be taking on pop culture news this week. Carolyn is in Germany educating the masses on the promise and potential of diversity in video games, and I'm just sitting here catching up on Endeavor and eating Clif Bars. So, Ebony, take it away. Thank you, Ebony. I will. First up, sad announcement in pop culture news. News broke yesterday that comics icon and movie cameo legend Stan Lee passed away at the age of 95. Now, listen, it's impossible to overstate the influence that Stan Lee, through Marvel, had on comics and our modern obsession with superheroes. The New York Times credits him with being a central player in the creation of almost every modern superhero you can name, from Thor to Spider-Man. Stan Lee was a tireless promoter and hustler, champion and cheerleader for these larger-than-life heroes, who nevertheless were quintessentially human. There has been an explosion of remembrances from all kinds of folks who loved him, from the A-list actors who swell the Marvel Universe on screen to, you know, everyday folks who just want to talk about how Stan Lee's work made their lives a little brighter. Personally, I met him about 8 years ago at Comic-Con. He couldn't have been more gracious and lovely. Excelsior, Mr. Lee. In wildly different pop culture news, folks are talking about the dizzyingly fucked up optics of a recent GQ cover featuring Serena Williams. Now, the magazine has named Williams Woman of the Year, but the word woman is in quotation marks. So to be very clear about what this looks like visually, the word man, which is typeset, has been crossed out, and woman, which is in a kind of brushstroke script, has been written above it and enclosed in quotation marks. Now, that's important. Think about what that looks like. For an athlete who's been harassed and vilified for years about being insufficiently feminine, and Black women know what that's about, right? It's an odd editorial and design choice, no matter what was meant. The fact that woman is in quotation marks serves to imply that there's something different, perhaps not wholly legitimate, about Williams being called a woman. Now, defenders of the cover point out that the artistic director at GQ is a designer named Virgil Abloh, who is known for using quotation marks around text in his work. So the stylistic choice to do so on this particular cover is a deliberate reference to his work. But here's the thing. The context for the decision matters, but it doesn't mean that the decision is any more defensible. When we're talking about a woman, no quotation marks, like Serena Williams, who has had her muscular, powerful body weaponized against her, this kind of like cheeky winking just plays into a gross undercurrent of misogynoir and yes, transmisia. So massive side eye from us here at Femme Freak Headquarters. And now, Anita, back to you.
All right. So today's main topic is A Star is Born, which I didn't know was actually like a remake of 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 a remake. But it is a movie starring Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, who also directed it. And it is about this iteration is about Jackson Maine, who is like an alcoholic and a drug addict. And he is a huge rock star. And he meets Lady Gaga, who is Allie, and he helps propel her musical career. How's that for a little description? So I watched the movie, and the whole time I was like, there were so many weird things in it that I was like, oh, this has got to be like a reference to some of the older movies, or this is that, you know, like I wanted to know where some of this stuff was coming from. So I actually went back and watched the 1976 movie version with Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson. And I watched about half of the 1954 version with Judy Garland. And yo, some of the weird ass shit in the Bradley Cooper episode was all him. Like that was
like,
not.
What exactly are you referring to when you say weird ass shit?
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Jigsaw is the fake dead guy on the floor.
Okay, so this is kind of a spoiler, but I mean, it is a spoiler. When he's talking about like his voice being taken from his brother and how he's taking steroids to make his voice that like vocal fry, growly kind of thing, like that shit ain't in the other versions. Like they added that tiny little weird shit that made very little sense into this version just for like kicks.
I thought it made a lot of sense to explain why Bradley Cooper sounded the way he did, just because, you know, there were moments where I thought, you know what, I buy that this person actually has hearing loss because there are things going on with the way that he sounds that to me mimic what happens when you have hearing loss and you cannot hear, like your sense of pitch is off, for instance. So I don't know, that didn't ring as weird to me,
really,
but,
where he was like, I stole your voice, and then I'm like, there's one shot where he's taking steroids and then that's it.
Well, the part about like, I stole your voice or you stole my voice, I thought was about like, you know, you stole my dream. You are living the life of a musician in front of crowds that I tried to grab for myself and that I wasn't able to achieve, you know? So like,
I don't give it that much generosity in the analysis. Like, yes, that is the like, that is what happened. But the fact that he like literally is taking steroids to make his voice deeper to sound like his brother is,
I mean, I didn't get that it had that kind of, I mean, I think that there are singers who give for whom live performance takes a toll on their vocal cords and things like that, and certainly certain modes of singing can be more demanding and more damaging to potentially to the vocal cords. But I guess I felt like that was more about like, I mean, there's a certain character to their voices, but I also felt like that was so much about the relationship between him and his father and his brother growing up that I guess I read it more in that way than about like, some sort of attempt to like directly imitate what, I don't know. I mean, I guess, I mean, I see what you're saying. It totally makes sense. I just, it didn't
it
seem
just
that
felt
weird
out
to me
left
in the
field
context
a little
of
bit.
The film.
But I also well, actually, hold on. Before I say, Carolyn, you're the one that wanted to see this movie more than any of us. So
yeah.
I will let you say what you thought first, because I have a lot of feelings about this movie.
What I thought of the movie. Well, I mean, I think it's a very competent piece of mainstream studio filmmaking.
Put that on the poster.
I mean, I do. I think that Bradley Cooper, you know, it's well directed. I think that Bradley Cooper's performance is surprisingly good. Like, I mean, I've spent a lot of time around alcoholics, and I think that he really, like, the way that he plays a borderline functional, but sometimes not functional alcoholic is, it rings very true. Like, that, I think his performance had a lot of depth to it. I was frustrated by specific ways that I felt the film shortchanged the character of Allie. Specifically, you know, there's a way in which I feel like the film wants to kind of function maybe as a critique of the pop music, like, mainstream commercial machine and what it can do to artists. But the failure there for me was in the fact that we don't really get to know what Allie herself thinks about the way, about what happens to her when she's on the rise as a pop star. And so for me, there's like this, ideologically, the film kind of ends up doing what I think is a problem with a lot of film, with a lot of like music criticism and a lot of the conversation around music, which is sort of suggesting that like male singer-songwriter artists have a kind of artistic purity to them, or their work is more like artistically valuable inherently than like a female, maybe pop star. You know, a good real life example we saw of that was maybe in some of the conversation around when Ryan Adams released his song for song cover album of Taylor Swift's 1989. And I love both of those albums. Like, I mean, I think that Ryan Adams' record is fascinating and does bring new, you know, qualities to some of those songs, but that's not to say that there weren't fascinating qualities in the original Taylor Swift recordings. And, you know, a lot of that was like, oh, you know, Ryan Adams makes real art out of Taylor Swift's disposable pop, you know, and there's, those conversations can be so gendered. And I felt like A Star Is Born didn't. I was frustrated with the politics of the film around that. But so, yeah, my feelings about it were complicated.
Yeah. I didn't love the movie. I didn't hate it per se, but it did sit with me. Like, Carolyn, I saw you a few days after I saw it, and like, I just couldn't stop talking about like bits of it, even though I like it. So it sat with me in a particular way, that, you know, sometimes you go and see a movie and it just like slides off, like you enjoyed it while you watched it and it just slides off. So this isn't a movie I necessarily liked, but it still like sits with me a bit. There's a couple of things. So another example of something that I was curious about was the whole bit around Lady Allie being like, I don't perform my own music because I'm not attractive enough, right? Which we learn in the film, which is not expressed in the trailer, that it's because of her nose, which I feel like made a lot more sense for me, because that is something that we've heard a lot, that like women have to change the way they look to be acceptable in Hollywood. And like, you hear about nose jobs all the time. Like, I remember in the 90s, like, that was a huge thing that like everyone was talking about. So I was curious, what I think is really interesting in the Streisand version, that is never talked about. And like, Streisand is not a conventionally like Hollywood attractive woman, even though she's like, watching her perform was like, I was like, God, I totally get why people love Barbara Streisand. Like, she played this role really well, and she's such a beautiful singer. But in the Judy Garland version, Judy Garland, who is very much like America's sweetheart, they say that about her nose. And you're like, What the fuck? This makes no sense to me at all. Anyways, just side note about some of the differences between the different movies.
I haven't seen any of the other versions. Carol, you've seen both of the other versions,
no, actually, right? Actually, I haven't. I watched the very beginning of the Kris Kristofferson, Barbara Streisand version, but I haven't, and I've seen important scenes from the Judy Garland version.
But also the Judy Garland version, the man in it is an actor. He's not a musician.
Right.
So that's also like, I don't know when that changed.
As a kid, I was so grossed out by the movie poster of the Kris Kristofferson, Barbara Streisand version, where they're like, you know, like hugging each other and they're both nude. Am I thinking of the right movie poster?
I'm going to Google that right now.
Google it right now. But I remember being so grossed out, but I was like, whatever this film is, it's garbage. I don't want to see it. So real quick, I had the opportunity because this movie felt interminable to me. I had a real flashback to my Call Me By Your Name situation.
I was just going to ask, did it feel longer or shorter than Call Me By Your Name?
It was definitely shorter.
Yes, wow. Ebony, I don't think I've ever seen this poster before, but you are totally right.
Yeah, like, it just grossed me out.
They're both like, they're both basically naked. Barbara Streisand has her hand on Christofferson's naked.
And there's like, there's too much hair. Like, it's too much skin and too much hair.
Very sensual.
Yeah. For certain values of sensual. But so I was not interested. I say this every time. Y'all, I'm not this salty all the time. I promise you. But I was not interested in going to see A Star Is Born because I'm not a Bradley Cooper fan. I don't dislike him by any means, but he's certainly not a draw. I am not a fan of Lady Gaga's music. So that didn't, and just the story didn't. So I knew going in that like there were these, you know, perhaps unfair hurdles that this movie had to clear. I found it absolutely, you know, assured filmmaking. I found the performances, you know, very assured. Like there wasn't a false note. Obviously, love seeing Sam Elliott. Glad
I was going to say,
love him.
Like I know, okay, you don't care for Bradley Cooper, you don't care for Lady Gaga, fine. But give love it up Sam for Elliott. My man Sam Elliott.
Exactly. I was a bit weirded out once I realized that Allie's dad was Andrew Dice Clay.
Right. How confusing was that when the credits rolled?
It was very confusing, and I was like, I'm uncomfortable being put in the position of, you know, warming to this dude who I only know as being this incredibly misogynist, racist, fuck up comic from the 80s, but whatever. But yeah, so this movie, it felt like, I don't know, like the kind of food that someone makes that you recognize is been crafted with care, but you're like, it's not for me. Like, it's just not to my taste. So I will, you know, forget entirely about this after the fact. But I have to say, the one thing that I did really respond to was the music. And specifically, and surprisingly, the music that Bradley Cooper sang on. I was entirely unready for the fact that, like, that first song that Bradley Cooper sings, Black Eyes, I lost my mind. I'm such a huge like roots rock fan, you know, like that's just my background. I grew up on my moment, whatever. But to me, it represented like the best of rock and roll, which to my mind, I have always said, if I'm listening to rock music, it better make me want to fuck somebody or kill somebody. And that song delivered.
So yeah, like Jackson Maine, if he were a real artist, is not like the kind of artist that I would be into at all. And yet that song, maybe it's time to let the old ways die.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a lot to change a man. It takes a lot to try. Like, I have had that song in my head so much since I saw this film. And I really like the way Bradley Cooper sings it. Like, I really like the sound of his voice on that song.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, I had a very kind of interesting journey as I watched the film. And I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, Caro, about the growth of Allie as a commercial artist through her pop music. We never know exactly how Allie feels about that. And I was confused because I thought, you know, are we meant to understand that she has both of these parts of her songwriting spirit, right? Like she is just as happy to do this kind of, you know, confectionery pop music. Like maybe her problem is with the dancers and the packaging of it, but the music itself is something she's very happy with, or she has somehow lost her way. Like, I don't think the movie is very clear on that, but because
we know exactly what Jackson Maine thinks, but we sure don't know what Allie thinks.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, although the movie is called A Star Is Born, the movie is about Jackson Maine. It is much less about Allie and who she is. We learn very little about her, except as she is reflected in Jackson's eyes. So his validation of her talent, her beauty, etc., undergirds the entire narrative such that we come to love her and accept her because he has given us permission to. He has led us to this point. But we never learn or know anything about Allie apart from, you know, her attachment to Jackson.
Yeah, I think one of my problems with the movie is so the theme throughout the movie, which I found, what was the word I used, Carolyn, when I was talking about this? Because it's not preachy, but it, do you remember?
Right.
I've been trying to remember the word because it's the right perfect word for this. But like the theme of I have something to say and real musicians have something to say. And that, like, you know, when he was like, you're to his brother, you didn't have anything to say. Or he says to Allie that people need to hear what you, or no, sorry, the producer guy says people need to hear what you have to say musically. And, you know, when Allie's sort of becoming more pop and less like, quote unquote, like real, authentic, Jackson says things to her like, if you don't dig deep into your soul, you won't have legs, or whatever it was that he said. And so, like, it was very over, like, it was very consistently over the top. It was very consistently like, oh God, I wish I could think of the word because it would explain exactly.
Patronizing?
How
it, bombastic?
No, none of that. It was like, it was just so, it was so arrogant and like, we are trying to say something and we're going to say it 25 times. Do you get it? And the thing that bothered me about it, though, is not that it, like, obviously it should have it. The movie should have something to say as well. But I think what's more interesting is they're trying to have a conversation about authenticity in artists and in artistry. And I think they fail at it. And part of it is because of what Carolyn brought up in terms of we don't ever know what Allie is thinking and why, whether she likes what she's doing or not, because the music is drastically different than what she was writing on her own. But I don't think that, like, you can't be an authentic pop star either, right? And the idea of authenticity is kind of a complicated, messy thing. And I think there's a bigger opportunity to flush that out in the day and age of YouTube and in the day and age of our current musical environment. And I thought about that more when, Carolyn, you posted an article in our Slack about, like, how this that while it tried to modernize the story, it doesn't talk at all about social media. It doesn't talk at all about YouTube. It doesn't talk about, like, the things that are a part of being a quote-unquote star today. And so I felt like it was trying to be deep, but it wasn't. It was really surface the whole time. And I was like,
Well, it tries to do that, right? In the, like, in the cop bar where the group comes up to Jackson and Allie and the guy wants to take a cell phone picture of him. And then when they're in the store immediately after that, and Lunel, the comic Lunel, who plays the cashier, he takes a surreptitious cell phone photo. So you're right. They don't take that. They don't tease that out far enough. But they certainly offer bits of that, you know, kind of like the modern reaction to celebrity.
Yeah, well, I mean, that stuff is interesting, but I think, like, and I appreciated that, but I think that the larger point is, like, what is real music? And what is being true to yourself in your artistry? And what are you willing to give up? Or what did you have to do in order to get to where you are? And, like, I kept feeling like that's what the movie was trying to talk about and failed at. Like, it just kept saying, you have something to say. Say something. You have to have something to say. Like, what the fuck does that even mean?
Yeah, and also, like, the music, you know, regardless of how you personally or I personally feel about the pop music that Allie starts creating, the fact is she is saying something to an audience that is hearing something and wants to hear it. And I found it problematic as fuck that Jackson and, you know, presumably the movie audience are supposed to assume that the pop music she is creating is somehow less worthy, especially when we see the audience for those pieces. And it's largely people of color. It's a lot of, you know, queer people in the audience. And I was like, that's messed up. You're saying that those audiences, what they're taking from Allie's performances and from her music, somehow that's, you know, it's superficial. It's not as deep. It's not as authentic as the stuff that Jackson Jackson is doing and performing to a largely white crowd. And I found that messed up.
But it is, though. Like, the movie is very clear on that is what we are supposed to take from it, because the pop music in the movie is fucking terrible. And I say that as someone who likes shitty pop music, right? Like, I will listen to, you know, like, top four, well, you know, whatever. And so, and clearly they had talented writers, because the music of Jackson Maine was very appealing in a lot of ways. And so they specifically picked music for Ali that was eye rolling. Like, I don't think a lot of people are like, you know, thinking that it's like off the charts amazing, which they could have done. And like, I like some of Lady Gaga's music, and I like how varied, you know, she put out a fucking country album, you know, like, she goes all over the place musically. And so, like, there is.
I don't know. I have problems with that, because, you know, again, I didn't, you know, respond to the pop music that she was performing. And I think, yeah, it is supposed to be, you know, like, there's supposed to be a sort of cringe inducing factor by, like, the lyrics, like, you know, back that ass up to me or whatever. But nevertheless, like, I reject wholeheartedly the notion that because the lyrics of pop music, the pop music as presented in this film, don't approximate the kind of, like, Americana poetry that Jackson Maine is putting out there, that it's somehow less valid. I think the audiences that are responding both to the pop music in this film and pop music in general are responding to the sense of community, you know, the sound of it, the way that it, you know, makes you want to dance. Like, there's more to it than just the words that the person is saying. There's a gestalt element to it that I think is being dismissed. And yeah, I think the racial element is really, like, that's something you can't ignore. Like, I was really struck by the fact that we see the faces in close-up of Ali's audiences, you know, going crazy for her. And it is so many people of color, so many gay people. But we see these larger crowd shots for Jackson. But when we do see them, it's primarily white folks. And I was just like, there's something that's not being talked about here, about the presumption of, you know, an intelligence of a certain kind of audience that I don't like.
Yeah, I think that the film is very intentionally saying something, and it was clear in the choices that they made to try to say this thing that I think they said badly and wrongly.
I don't know. I don't know. When I say that, like, the movie is not going to, you know, sit with me, that it's just going to, like, rush off my back. Clearly it's not. Of course, I did just see it yesterday, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, like, I think also one of my problems is that it keeps, like, trying to introduce these things to create depth, and I didn't ever feel like there was depth there. So, like, you know, the very first scene, the first scene with Ali is she's breaking up with her partner or date or whatever in a bathroom, and she walks out of the bathroom, and it's this beautiful shot that's like a side profile, like, long shot, and she just screams "fucking men," and I was like, I love you, this is awesome. But also you see that, like, her boss is a dick, and she, like, and so they're trying to set up that she just kind of is done and tired of men in general. But there's nothing really, like, and so when she falls in love with Jackson Maine, it's like, oh, like, he's for real. But it felt so forced and so stilted and so unnecessary. Like, you didn't really need to be so forceful with it, because it felt so cheap to me.
Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't. So for me, so that first night, they have this whole long, like, the film really takes its time with their, like, their first meeting. Like, that night goes on and on. They go to, like, a parking, they just talk in a parking lot, mm-hmm, of a grocery store at, like, 3 a.m. for a while and stuff like that. And, like, there are things that Jackson says during that time where, you know, Ali is, like, opening up to him about her insecurities. You know, he's taking a real interest in her as not just, like, you know, somebody who's, like, physically attractive, but as an artist, as a songwriter. You know, he asks her, like, do you write your own songs? And you know, when she talks about, like, being considered unattractive or insecurity around her nose, like, he says things to her that make it seem like he's really looking at her and really seeing her as a person. And I guess I responded to that. I was like, oh, I get why, you know, because, so when I saw trailers and stuff for this movie, I sort of rolled my eyes at Lady Gaga's character saying, like, oh, you know, people have always told me they like my songs, but they don't like the way I look. I'm like, you know, please, you're like incredibly attractive. But as you said, like within the context of the film, I understand that a little bit more. And certainly, like, you know, I, to some degree, I can like relate to that in a way, a feeling of like, oh, you know, I know what it is to not be considered conventionally attractive and to have people not like, to have people, you know, comments on GameSpot, for instance, were like very antagonistic about the fact that I was hired even though I wasn't hot enough to please like the main, you know, male audience of the site or whatever. So as he's talking to her and like seemingly seeing her in a real way, I warmed up to it and I was like, oh, I get like why that would be powerful, because the world usually doesn't make her feel seen in a real way. And he kind of is doing that. And so I guess I
don't think that they do a good, like, I agree with you that like that's what they were doing. Like, that's right. What they're trying to do. I just feel like it was really stilted because they're trying to force a lot in. And like, it just, you know, that never comes up again. It's not like a recurring thing, you know, like it's, you know, she's having a hard time dealing with him, but I don't know. It just felt so like, it just felt cheap to me.
I don't know. I think I bought their connection. Their chemistry felt real to
me. I feel like her hating men felt cheap to me, not their connection.
Gotcha.
Just to clarify.
Gotcha.
Like, I agree with that. I think that they worked off each other really well, actually.
I did too. And in fact, by the end of the film, I weirdly, even though I felt as if I had been in that theater for 17 hours, I was like, I kind of wanted the timeline jumps were so odd to me. I never really knew where we were in our journey. You know, if like, you know, we once Allie and Jackson actually get together and she has agreed to go on tour with him, suddenly she's, you know, singing background. Then next we see her actually playing on certain songs. Then we have, you know, the concert where she actually takes the encore, you know, then she's cutting her first single. Then she does her album, you know, then suddenly she's nominated for 3 Grammys. I had to laugh though at the moment because she seemed so surprised by the fact that the Grammys were coming up and that she had been nominated, as if there's not like this huge lead up and, you know, sort of, will this person be nominated for a Grammy in the media? You know, it's if she and Jackson live these completely isolated lives that I just didn't buy, whatever.
Yeah, the pacing was
but
off.
I had no idea like how long they had been together, what their relationship was like on a day-to-day basis. And I really did want more of that, particularly because, as Carol mentioned, Bradley Cooper played a drunk in this very well. And it was very hard for me to watch at some points because he embodied that so well. And so we don't see a lot of the day-to-day life with an alcoholic that would absolutely have affected their relationship. And I thought that was a real lack. For me.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I felt like I always felt the presence of his alcoholism in their relationship. I mean, it's true we don't maybe spend as much time in kind of mundane, like, oh, what's it like just having dinner at home kind of situations, because the film is so much about their lives like on the road and as stars. But I don't know. Like, there, you know, there's this one scene where he hasn't been drinking, right? And she says, like, you haven't been drinking, I can tell. And he's like, you're right, I haven't. And, you know, I felt that, like, that painful, like, oh, that uplift of hope that you know is gonna, that you know is false hope, and that you know that what's coming again, that they're not, like, that he's not sober, like, as a, you know, that he hasn't committed to sobriety in a way that's going to last or anything. Like, seeing him, who he can be when he's not drinking, for like that flash, it's, oh, that was like a knife twisting in me, because it's like, oh god, yeah, like that's part of what happens when you love an alcoholic, right? Is then you see them, you see like the person they can be sometimes, but who they're usually not. And it's, and that, yeah, you know, I that, oof, man, that I thought that worked really well.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess maybe.
But I mean, not to take away from your, I mean, yeah, no, I'm just saying like, for me as, you know, with regard to my experiences with alcoholics, and I guess, I guess I came to the film with some sort of charitable, like, you know, the sort of understanding of, okay, it's trying to tell the story of an entire relationship in two hours and 15 minutes, et cetera. And it wants to have a bunch of songs in there too. I mean, for that kind of for the economics of what the film has to work with narratively, I felt it hit a lot of the right beats within its scope. So
yeah, I guess, you know, I would have preferred less time spent at the beginning of their relationship with that first night and more time in the middle sort of meat of their relationship, particularly as we see Allie's star start to wax and Jackson start to wane, because it did feel a little bit abrupt to me that, you know, he's going from playing these stadium rock shows to then playing like this pharmaceutical convention, right? To, you know, the point at the end or near the end when Allie's getting ready for the her last show at the Forum, and their positions have been pretty neatly reversed, right? So she says to him, "I'll send a car for you," you know? So I would have wanted more time in the middle to track their relationship versus, you know, the first, you know, 30, 40 minutes it felt like on the beginning. But I don't know. And I don't know why I'm spending so much time on this movie that will evaporate from my brain in, you know, half an hour after we record this podcast.
Yeah, you can delete. You can safely delete these files.
Rave review.
As soon as we're done having this conversation.
Listen, the movie was 2 hours and 14 minutes long, and I know I'm having trouble in a film when I actually Google during a film runtime.
Oh my God!
And so, like, I actually.
So it's really funny because usually Ebony's in between Carolyn and I, but like I have issues with it, but I didn't dislike it that much.
I didn't dislike it either. It was so weird. I honestly flashed back to my experience watching Call Me By Your Name, where I was like, maybe I should have seen this at a different time. You know, I don't know, but I just wasn't in the mental space to fully immerse myself in it. And so consequently, I never went too far below the water. And I kept struggling for the surface. But yeah, so part of my brain was always kind of disconnected. And I did feel as if while the movie as a whole, as I said, felt very, assured, it was very competent filmmaking. It wasn't my story. I didn't feel as if the movie was saying anything to me specifically, except during the course of that rock music.
And did that feel like a slap in the face that the filmmakers made a film that was not
Carolyn,
designed with
no
Ebony,
king,
Ebony Adams
no
in
kings
mind.
Last forever. No king lasts forever. Yeah. I lay down my sword. I will no longer fight this. But yeah, so I during the course of watching this film, as our producer Phil sometimes notes, I tend to think in segment ideas. And I was like, I really need to start doing a segment of the show specifically for people like who watch movies like me, that's called Runtime Rundown. So like before the movie even starts, before we get into it, I'll be like, okay, this movie was 180 minutes. You're going to be able to get through the first 60 with no trouble. Minutes 61 through 120 are going to take a little bit of extra juju fruits. You know, you're going to need to kind of take a B12 shot to get through that. And then the last bit, but I'm going to start offering that service as often as Anita will allow. That's Runtime Rundown. Vote if you would like to hear from Ebony about that particular segment.
Runtime Rundown.
How long is this movie?
Oh boy. All right. On that note, we should get into freaking out a little bit. So what's your freak out? Carolyn, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, my freak out this week is the book Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit.
Oh, who got you that book, huh?
I don't remember. No, you did. Anita Sarkeesian purchased that book as a gift for me. And I have to say, like a lot of Solnit's books, it's a slender collection of essays around a particular theme. And, you know, the overarching theme of Hope in the Dark is really like maintaining hope, not just hope itself, but the struggle for a better world, especially in those times when hope itself seems baseless, when things feel, or when people start to feel as if things are hopeless. And she finds in her writing, she offers up like very substantial, reasons, looking back through the history of activism and just through human history, reasons why we should maintain hope, ways in which, even if certain social justice movements haven't succeeded on the terms that the people who created them or participated in them hoped they might succeed, it doesn't mean that they didn't have significant lasting impact and lead to other things that led to other things that led to other things that have made the world somewhat less oppressive for some people. She creates a narrative that makes, for anyone who's, I think, does any kind of activist work, she makes you feel part of a larger history of people who have, in one way or another, worked towards creating a better world. And so specifically, a few weeks ago, the New York Times, I woke up on a Sunday to the headline about Trump's administration trying to define transgender out of existence, essentially, to basically define gender as a direct, result of one's the gender one is assigned at birth, to put it in very simple terms. I was, really struggling and feeling especially hopeless for a while in the wake of that. And having Solnit's book as beautifully written but also incredibly smart book that illuminates, concrete reasons why we should continue fighting and why continuing to fight will make a difference in the long term, has been, a particular kind of comfort and inspiration in this particularly dark and challenging time.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's really good. I like what she does with drawing connections between, like, this movement failed, but it inspired this other movement that succeeded.
Right.
Some of that stuff I found really hopeful. Anyways, all right, Ebony, what's your freak out?
I have two completely unrelated. So just recently I finished watching season 3 of Daredevil on Netflix.
I'm sorry.
I'm not. I enjoyed, of all of the Marvel shows that have been on Netflix, I have enjoyed, Daredevil's been near the top. I've consistently enjoyed it. I don't have much to say about it yet, but I feel that I will. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff going on with disability in that show and depictions of disability and mental illness that I really want to unpack. So that's one thing that I am experiencing a preliminary freak out about, to the point that I actually went back and recently have been rewatching season 1 of Daredevil because I want to kind of untangle my thoughts on it, which I hope to offer at a later date. The other thing I am freaking out about is I am reading Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I really enjoyed the movie that came out, 5-6 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, with Gary Oldman as George Smiley. But I had never read the book. In fact, I've never read any John le Carré books. So I'm finding it really interesting. I've only read about, a quarter of it so far. But one of the things that I'm most interested in is the analog to actual counter agents in the British Secret Service and British intelligence and the role that class played And so characters like or figures like Kim Philby, who was a Russian double agent who was very highly placed in British intelligence services, people like him who were from very elevated class positions in England, and the kind of radicalism that they themselves latched onto because of their the ways they kind of worked out their class privilege in these political ways. I don't know. I'm just finding it very, very interesting. And it's not something that I know much about. So I'm looking forward to finishing this book. It's quite different from the movie. And unfortunately, I haven't seen any of the Alec Guinness versions of George Smiley, but I would like to check those out as well. But as these sort of like nearly, you know, homogenous, all male, all privileged worlds that are explicitly tasked with preserving a certain version of the nation. I'm just fascinated. So Daredevil on the one hand, also about white men preserving a certain version of community, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So that's what I'm freaking out about.
Cool. I'm freaking out in the most negative way possible about Final Fantasy Spirits Within. Do you remember this, Carolyn?
What? I mean, is that the movie,
yeah,
the CGI movie with like Alec Baldwin and stuff
yeah.
in it?
All right, so it's a Final Fantasy movie that was released in 2001. It was like a huge deal. It had Alec Baldwin, Steve Buscemi, Donald Sutherland as like voice actors in it. It had a budget of $137 million. And I think like it was something like $46 million of it went to building a studio in Hawaii because the guy who made it really wanted a studio in Hawaii or something. And so when it is garbage. Like, it is the most garbage bullshit. $137 million was the budget. It managed to gain $85 million worldwide. It was like one of the biggest box office bombs of all time. And it's funny because, not funny, it's really bad. Like, really bad. But the hair of the main character, who's a woman, is so fucking good that, like, we still have not gotten hair that good in video games. Like, I don't know that, like, I think that maybe the other 100 million of the budget was to going towards her hair and not paying any of the writers. Also, the rocks and like the fire and the explosion, like the everything else looked like shit except for her fucking hair. Anyways, I didn't really voluntarily watch the movie. I was told to come to a movie night and I didn't know what it was and I didn't know it was going to be this terrible thing.
Well, it sounds fascinatingly bad.
I was watching it with a bunch of game developers and like people in the games industry, and it was amusing to, you know, watch a bad movie in a group of people, but it was like, I don't really like watching bad movies. Like, some people really enjoy it and think it's funny, but it's never been my thing. And so it was just kind of like, it's just kind of painful. And halfway through, I was like, oh, this is the story. The story is collecting the things because video games. I was like, oh, it's not like getting to the point. This is the point. Anyways, it was just bad. So don't watch it if you haven't, and don't rewatch it if you have watched it. And yeah, there you go.
Sound advice.
Yeah. You can submit your own freakout and it might make it onto the show. Just head over to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That is FREQOUT. I can spell. That was really hard. That's our show, and you can, yes, that is our show. That's our show. That
is that our
show? You can catch us back.
Is the Anita robot break? Can somebody like jiggle the handle?
Turn it off and restart it.
Yeah.
Reboot the Anita bot.
Yeah. Okay. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday, and stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available as a backer of this podcast. And you know what? It's so easy to be a backer of this podcast. You just got to head over to d.rip/femfreak and, you know, click a couple buttons and you'll be all set. If you're enjoying this show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell all your friends. But you know where you shouldn't tell your friends? At a fucking concert. Stop talking through goddamn concerts. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can catch us individually as well. Carolyn?
I am at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony?
I am Baby Sound 11 Always Die.
It's a really long handle. And I'm at Anita Sarkeesian. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, and art by Jamie Barron. See y'all next week.
Bye.
Later.